Good afternoon. Welcome to another episode of the Legends Among Us podcast. My name is Chaplain Jason Phipps, and this is a podcast devoted to the troopers and veterans of 3rd Cavalry Regiment. And we have another great episode this week. We have Colonel Todd Hertling, the brigade commander for the Iron Horse Brigade, 1st Armored Brigade Combat Team, 1st Cavalry Division. Sir, great to have you on. Thank you for joining us today.
And Jason, thank you for having me today. I look forward to talking with you.
Good. Well, usually the way this goes, sir, is that I like to just kind of ask, you know, get a little bit of background from our guests. So any kind of background that you'd like to share in terms of how you came into the Army. I know that we're going to talk a little bit about your time in Sabre Squadron and your time here at 3CR. But if you would, sir, just spend a couple minutes, 1 or 2 minutes, talk about your background.
Sure. I grew up in a military family, in an Army family. So we moved around quite a bit, and I was well-versed in those experiences. And so when I was applying for college, I was interested in Wake Forest University as my number one pick, and also decided to apply for an RTC scholarship, mainly out of curiosity to see what it was all about. And truth in lending, my parents' jaws both dropped. I don't know that they necessarily thought I would take that route. And as it turns out, with each passing year as a cadet at Wake Forest, I enjoyed it more and more. And I said, okay, this is what service is all about. And I would like to embark on this tradition, and this is a calling.
And so what year did you commission, sir?
This was in 2002. Okay. My senior year of college, of course, we had experienced 9/11, and I right. knew that I just had an intuition that within a year we would probably be deployed somewhere in the world doing our nation's bidding.
Did your MS instructors give you that impression, or that's a curious time to be in ROTC, was during those formative years around 9/11.
Yes. And what stands out in my mind is I had a infantry major named Brian Coppersmith, who really served as a mentor when I was a cadet. And he fared from the 101st. And I remember he posted an eagle cartoon, like it was one of an eagle like sharpening talons in the wake of 9/11. And ooh. So to see that image from a combat arms officer on the Wake Forest cadre kind of gave me an indication of where we might be headed. He seemed to believe that this was what was next for that graduating class of cadets.
Oh, wow. So you commissioned, sir, as an armor officer, is that correct?
I did.
Okay, so you branched armor. Second lieutenant, what was your first assignment?
My first assignment was to Fort Carson, Colorado, and the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment.
Okay, all right. So your time, and I was trying to determine this before you came onto the show, whether or not, and I was not doing a great job with the math. I wasn't sure if you did troop command time or if you were a PL or if you were actually a squadron commander, but have you had multiple touch points, or was that your first and only experience?
I served, generally speaking, from 2002 to 2006, okay. All the way from brand new rookie second lieutenant to young captain, newly promoted captain.
Okay.
And that's been the extent of my time with the regiment.
Well, those are formative years. I mean, that's pre-surge era, but I'm always interested when we bring guests onto the show, particularly those who have some history with the organization during the GWAT era, what it was like. It was armored back then. We talked a little bit about that when we were doing Warfighter a few weeks back. It was an armored organization. It was not kind of a striker / light infantry organization like it is now. So what was the mission set for you as a young lieutenant going into combat during that GWAT era?
Right. So there were clear advantages to the Armored Cavalry Regiment, not least of which was its enormous combat power. During my service with Sabre Squadron, for instance, the MTO for the squadron included Fox, Eagle, Grim, and heavy troops. Okay. Fox, Eagle, and Grim, of course, had 2 tank platoons and 2 scout platoons with 6 Bradleys each. And the heavy company had tank platoons only as the hammer for the squadron. But it was also interesting because we had a howitzer battery and also the 43rd engineers. So we had a fires capability and an engineer capability organic to the squadron, which is different than what we experience today, of course. Also organic to the ACR writ large was its air cav squadron. So in the case of 2nd Squadron, 3rd ACR, Sabre, we had a habitual relationship with the Outlaw Troop, which had OH-58 Deltas. And that air-ground integration relationship was near habitual. I knew, after several deployments, I knew who the pilots were over us just by the sound of their voice. And we had opportunities to dine with them, break bread, and do those sorts of things during the deployment itself. Before we even received orders to deploy, it was interesting because we were still caught in this world of what you might describe as large-scale combat operations today, right? That was the world we were planning for and training for. That was the enemy we were planning to fight. And of course, it ended up evolving into something much different with the counterinsurgency strategies.
Of course. Speaking specifically about the culture, so you kind of left the orbit of, at the time, 3 ACR to go off and do great things in other organizations. Where else did you go beyond your time there after 2006?
After my time with 3rd ACR, I jumped on an Army opportunity to go to grad school at Indiana University. So got my master's in public affairs and then returned to 1st Armored Division and 6-1 CAV out of the Ready First.
Okay.
So I had an opportunity to deploy with that unit again. From that point forward, I went on to teach in the Department of Social Sciences at West Point. Then I returned to the operational force as a major with 166 Armor, 3rd Brigade, 4th ID at Fort Carson, then went on to be the Brigade 3 for another deployment, this time to Kuwait. And that deployment also ended up being a little bit sporty as well. Back up, that was during my time with 166 Armor. We deployed to Kuwait. That culminated actually in an activation of a part of our battalion as a CENTCOM reserve to respond to a crisis in the Sinai Peninsula, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you have come now to assume command within Iron Horse Brigade. Is this your first time within the vicinity of 3CR?
Yes.
Since you were in the war?
This is my first time being close to 3rd CR since I was a young captain.
Okay. So I know you spent a little bit of time with us during Warfighter, but I'm curious to know from your perspective, particularly for our younger listeners, have you noticed any significant cultural shifts since you were there in the early 2000s to now?
The short answer is no. I spent only a short period of time with the 3rd Cavalry Regiment in this latest exercise, of course, but sure. I think what stands out to me with the Brave Rifles is that it is a culture of pride.
Hmm.
It's a sense of esprit de corps, and that's been fairly timeless with this particular organization. My sense is that even today, that esprit is present and pervasive. We certainly had it, or I felt it, when I served with the regiment from 02 to 06, and I think it still exists today. I will say that at its time, the Armored Cavalry Regiment was the only unit of its kind to be doctrinally suited for a core cover mission, right? So there is a disparity there between what it was designed to do then and the combat power that it brought to bear and then what it is designed to do now. But I think what characterizes all cavalry troopers is the disciplined initiative that they always exhibit and the sense of purpose that they are serving something greater than themselves.
You have largely been immersed in a culture of 19 series. Is that correct,
sir? That's right.
So obviously we have a culture of 11 series over here. Are there any differences just when you think about personality types, devotion to the mission or to cultivating lethality within their warfighting functions between those two MOSs as you have had interactions to some degree with both?
I think largely speaking, there's parity when it comes to the focus on lethality.
Okay.
It really becomes a question of the platform or the capability that the particular S is bringing to bear and how they treat and maintain that capability, whether it's an M4 rifle or whether it's an M2A4 Bradley.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking, sir, is because we talked about before, and as you know, we're moving back to an ACR model here in roughly 2 years. We're going to be standing up Long Knife again. So in my mind, I come from the light world primarily until I spent some time in a DRU and with TRADOC. So this is my first exposure at the brigade level to the operational world. And it's very similar to what I observed in the light world, minus the fact that we're just not jumping out of airplanes. But I do wonder, in my limited understanding of combat arms, what the culture might look like within 2 or 3 years when we have in a more pervasive way, 19 series guys running around versus 11 series guys. And maybe that doesn't matter in light of what the Department of War just put out today, but I'm just kind of curious what you think the future might look like.
Well, so it's interesting, and just to kind of put an exclamation point on this particular question of how we differentiate MOSs, we're experiencing a little bit of that in Iron Horse right now, where some of our soldiers are reclassified to 19 Charlies, right, which essentially means they're gunners or Bradley commanders on an M2A4, and they may have been 11 series previously. I think what soldiers respond to is intent from their command team, and if there's clear intent that we will be a lethal formation and this is the horse you're riding in on, then soldiers by and large absorb that and they embrace it. And if you can foment some competitiveness associated with that as well, all the more power to that command team. And we happen to be going through a gunnery progression right now where maybe some of the infantrymen who recently came on board and are being asked to serve in mounted roles are experiencing that for the first time. And it's a matter of what's the climate we're setting to ensure that they are successful and take on the competitive edge to be lethal on these platforms.
Good to hear, sir. Well, let's dial it back just a little bit, because one of the things that I always like to do for those who have been in this organization in the past, particularly those who have deployed to a combat zone, is just to kind of hear some stories of valor, some stories of virtue, how we have employed armor to defeat the enemies of our country. But sir, thoughts, perspectives on that? What do you maybe recall?
So I recall with OIF-1, the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, basically having all of Al-Anbar province. And there were probably too many stories of valor to count. That was a sporty environment.
Sure.
It was contested. It was a nascent insurgency. And you had a lot of leaders, junior leaders, who were doing the best that they could to respond to new and complicated problems with disciplined initiative. And we really saw that across the board. Sabre Squadron was characterized with a Valorous Unit Award after its mission in 2003. And I think, like, what was most impressed upon me was the advent of how soldiers and leaders dealt with the advent of the IED, which I didn't even know what an improvised explosive device was. Sure. At the front end of that deployment. I don't think any of us were. But when we started losing leaders like Captain Josh Beyer, who's a former Fox 6 from Sabre Squadron, we had a lot of teams and leaders and troopers who responded to those sorts of IED attacks in the future with a lot of judgment, when perhaps it would have been tough to exhibit that judgment, and being careful to understand what the enemy's tactics, techniques, and procedures were, and then in kind respond with thoughtfulness as to how we will address this threat effectively while still avoiding collateral damage and unnecessary harm and killing of civilians. So there were those sorts of efforts, again, too many to count across the squadron. I'd probably be remiss if I tried to pinpoint any one organization, but really all of them are doing that.
So we just got done with the CPX last week. We spent about 2 days in the field, 2 or 3 days, and we did probably what I would determine to be like the most intense, focused session of MDMP. And of course, we went through the process of COA development, COA comparison. We actually had like 8 turns during wargaming. I'm trying to imagine in the early stages of GWAT, when we're trying to fight asymmetrically with an insurgent force, what did planning look like during that time for an armored unit?
In OIF-1, the planning was flexible, to say the least. We had a lot of learning to do, and we tried to stay ahead of the threat as best we could with the basics of our craft, which would include, at the platoon leader and platoon sergeant level, which I was, planning and delivering good 5-paragraph op orders. And that's how we tried to stay ahead of the threat with planning and execution of missions. As we came out of that first deployment in OIF-1 in Al-Anbar province, and we served in such places as Fallujah, Ramadi, the Syrian and Jordanian borders, I had been a tank platoon leader, scout platoon leader during that time. And so we learned a lot from that deployment, and then we redeployed. And then as then Colonel H.R. McMaster assumed command of the regiment in between our deployments. I remember distinctly him mentioning in his change of command ceremony that we were going to be deploying in another 10 months. So we had two back-to-back deployments there. And then the second would be initially to southern Baghdad. And then we got a change of mission from 3 Corps to be the main effort. This is Sabre Squadron still. And at this point, I'm a support platoon leader for the squadron. We received a change of mission to go to Tal Afar, which had really become a center of gravity for Al-Qaeda, and namely Abu Musab Zarqawi. So you asked about valor and how our own responses to that may have, to the enemy TTPs, may have changed over time and shaped strategy. Tal Afar, of course, is an Operation Restoring Rights was the named operation where we countered Attack Fury threat in the city, some of the worst and most complex urban and terrain that I've ever seen. And from that would emerge the strategy for the surge. So for veterans in the audience, like, that's something we hold a lot of pride for, is service during that period of time in 2005 and what it meant for the future of Iraq and how our surge strategy really emerged from some of the things that we did in Tal Afar to really combine addressing the enemy threat with other elements of local economic development.
Thank you for sharing that, sir. I want to fast forward now to just a couple weeks ago. You were out at the Maneuver Warfighter Conference. Colonel Chastain was out there with you as well. There's been a lot of talk about TIC 2.0 transformation in contact, but I would love to hear what you gleaned from that conference, how that might apply to combat with a near-peer threat. I'm assuming there was some discussion about that and how we might better employ movement and maneuver, but specifically armor assets in that type of environment.
I think first what it reinforced for me is how grateful I am to be a part of this installation in the 1st Cavalry Division team, and by extension, the 3rd CR and all of its efforts to transform and to spearhead that change on behalf of the Army. As I try to message this with our own Iron Horse team, if you can think of the metaphor of an obstacle belt, there are all sorts of things in this obstacle belt, including AT mines, flank shots by enemy infantry who can target our armored platforms. There's a transparency of that obstacle belt wherein the enemy can see everything we do and we can see everything that he does. There's GPS jamming. There's an EW signature. There is the employment of fires in that obstacle belt. This is the overmatch that potentially we could face if we don't change very quickly as a U.S. Army. And what we want to avoid is encumbering ourselves on a stalemate situation along the lines of what we're seeing in Ukraine right now. So all of that is to say there's a gap. There's potential overmatch by an enemy, and we as a U.S. Army are better than that. We have to address that gap with a sense of urgency as quickly as possible and meet this threat on our own terms so that we maintain positions of advantage, vice situations of stalemate on the modern battlefield.
Was there more discussion about the multifunctional core supports concept while you all were down there as well? I know we tried to employ that during Warfighter, but I wasn't sure if there was more discussion about that during that conference.
It did come up periodically in discussions. Okay. I don't know that it was a centerpiece of any discussion, but one thing is clear. I think most leaders understand that the rear area is a different environment now than maybe what we're used to. And it's not safe to assume that our sustainment nodes, for example, are going to be protected in their current configuration. So along with the changes we're making to adopt our warfighting portion of the formation, we also have to take care to ensure that our sustainment elements, our warfighters themselves, and protecting themselves using passive protective measures, being careful about how we disperse logistics and supply to the rest of the formation. For an ABCT, which emits a massive signature, that's very important, and we probably should not lose sight of that. And if we do, it's to our own detriment. So a current effort within our brigade is to really take a close look at our brigade support battalion and how we're taking into account transformation in that formation as well.
So you may not be thinking about this, or you might be somewhat removed at your echelon of leadership, but what would you say to like a brand new second lieutenant armor officer that's coming into 1st Cavalry Division or coming to like an ACR, just to prepare them not only for what will be expected of them professionally and tactically, but just as a person? Because we're getting older, but those guys continue to be young and stay the same age. So how do you address those?
Sure. Well, there is much talk of transformation. And what I tell our leaders as they come on board is it's easy to get enamored by the materiel solutions that may be coming our way. It's easy to get enticed by the technologies and how it may cure all that ails our formation at each echelon. But really, transformation to me is about the human spirit and transformative leadership. That is a timeless element of the U.S. Army, of which I'm very proud. That doesn't change over time. So I think for new young leaders, focusing on the human dimension, understanding that it's mission first and people always, and the people always portion of that is taking care of our own people, ensuring that their needs and challenges are addressed so that they can focus on mission accomplishment. That doesn't change. And that still demands that young leaders approach each mission with a focus on mastering the fundamentals and doing routine things routinely above and beyond what the technology has to offer. So if we can do the routine things routinely and operate effectively with our basics, then we'll be fully ready, I believe, to embrace the technology and what it has to offer. But if we do one over the other, if we embrace the technology first and we skip over all of the other imperatives of leadership, including the human element, then that probably won't end well for any of us. So there's still an importance for critical thinking, still an importance for judgment and character. And above all else, the oath of commission requires us to exhibit good judgment in our decisions.
Do you think, like I think about the Big Five, I wonder if this was an issue back in the 70s and 80s when we were developing new platforms, updating new platforms. Do you think that force design update or force management, we become needlessly enamored with that to the point where we lose sight of the human element more than we should? And do you think younger generations are more prone to that versus older generations who maybe didn't have the same capabilities or rest in the same capabilities that exist today?
It's an interesting question for sure. I'm not sure I'd go as far as to say we've lost sight of it, but it may require us to just do a check on learning periodically. Yeah. And again, I think leaders have a role, commanders have a role in setting that sort of climate so that there aren't any false impressions about what's most important.
Sure. Okay, well, sir, just to kind of wrap things up, obviously we have a number of troopers that come here. I'm sure this happens in the brigades at division as well, but you have young troopers that come to Fort Hood because they don't know any better. They're just assigned here and they arrive, they don't know what to expect, but then they kind of develop in some cases maybe a negative thought loop based upon whatever information they receive or whatever experiences or impressions that they gather from their peers. How would you discourage that type of thinking for a new soldier or perhaps a young officer who arrives here and maybe this wasn't their first pick in terms of a duty station?
So first, I would just say, in my experience, and perhaps I'm biased, but I have not seen better leaders at the lieutenant colonel and the command sergeant major level really across the installation than I have with my time here at Fort Hood thus far. It's super impressive. And it's clear to me, actually, that the Army has prioritized, I think, this installation with really good leadership.
That's good to hear.
And the other thing I would say is the focus on change and leading that change for the Army. It's being done at Fort Hood. It's an amazing opportunity to learn, to do what we do as professionals and get better. And in my time in the Army, 23 years to date, I have not been a part of an organization that is spearheading change on behalf of the Army. It's a mission, I think, that resonates. And if it doesn't, then you're probably missing the boat, right? There's a real opportunity to do good and to make the U.S. Army a better institution and one that's more effective at warfighting. And ultimately, when I think about the why behind that, well, I've got you know, five kids that we parent, and I want the world to be a better place for them. And I think it starts with what we do here today at Fort Hood, and there's no better place in the Army to do it.
Well, I appreciate your insights and your opinion on that, because that is still sometimes a battle that we have to fight, just as a culture here within Fort Hood, that we're constantly fighting that uphill battle of what impression does the American public think of this place? What is the impression that soldiers have of this organization, of the division, but 3CR specifically, but also Fort Hood? So appreciate you shedding some light on that.
The other thing I would mention on that is just from a quality of life standpoint. Yes, it's hot here, but my right. wife and I, we've taken time to visit the surrounding areas just about every weekend since we've been here. And in the surrounding community of Fort Hood, we've never come across like kinder individuals
yeah.
who are more supportive of yeah. their installation. And there are just really amazing opportunities not too far from Hood as well, if you're interested in a day trip. So lots of fun stuff to do. And I would encourage leaders not to take counsel of the biases that may exist.
Yes, agreed, 100%. Well, Colonel Hertling, I really do appreciate your time. I know it's valuable, and I know you all have a lot going on with Division CPX, so I don't want to keep you, but I do immensely appreciate your time here on the show. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Jason, and Brave Rifles.
Veteran, sir. That was Colonel Todd Hertling, Brigade Commander for 1st Armored Brigade Combat Team, 1st Cavalry Division. Great to have him on the show. It's always good to have senior leaders who have some previous history with 3CR joining us on the show. So if you liked what you heard, please leave some comments on any of your favorite streaming platforms for the podcast. Give us a thumbs up. Look us up on Facebook. We're on Facebook and Instagram. And we're always advertising on the digital kiosk in the Theodore Roosevelt Dining Facility. So have a great week, and we will talk again soon. Aiyah!